Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, they claim to be like civil rights leaders. But are companies like Uber, Airbnb, and Google instead introducing a new form of corporate lawlessness? And first, scientists have made fascinating discoveries about animals and how they communicate. For one, bird songs are more than music to the ears of the forest. As it turns out, they're speaking a language understood by many species, particularly when they're warning of approaching dangers. Eric Green is with us. He's a professor of biological sciences at the University of Montana. He's published widely in ornithology, most recently with the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Eric Green. Great to have you here.
Thank you. It's wonderful to chat with you.
Maybe we should start with the overall find, this idea of communication, not just within species, but across species. And I read that these birds are communicating with each other, particularly warning about coming danger. What else might they be communicating?
Well, that's a great question that we're just starting to scratch the surface of. The world is a really pretty noisy place, so birds and lots of animals and crickets, and they're yakking all the time, and it turns out that they're communicating lots and lots of information to each other about a wide variety of things. So, for example, people all around the world love bird songs, which are complex, and we tend to think of them as beautiful, and those are associated with courtship, so males defending territories and trying to attract the babes and so forth. But birds will say lots and lots of other things, so they'll have very specific calls, many, many, many calls, and what's pretty amazing is even for the most common birds that we have right in our backyards, we don't even know what all the sounds that they produce mean. As researchers, we're just beginning to sort of put together Rosetta Stones, so to speak, for understanding sort of the communication codes of all the animals that we share the world with. So sex is one big thing, so courtships and song is one big thing that critters yak about. But danger about predators is really, really important as well. So we're finding that many birds and mammals and lots of things produce very specific what we call alarm calls when they detect a predator. And so these sorts of signals are vitally important for them because it can alert others to the presence of a predator that could kill them.
I thought what was also fascinating was that other animals listen to the birds for those warnings, like squirrels, one of the species that listen. So what's going on here?
So this is something that we're just beginning to appreciate. So if you walk out in the woods, lots of birds of many, many species, they're all listening to each other for these very specific alarm calls. Because if there's, let's say, a hawk in the woods, it's not only dangerous to a robin, let's say, but perhaps to a chickadee or other things as well. So many, many species of birds are all listening in to each other, and it turns out that lots of mammals in the area, so squirrels and chipmunks and so forth, also produce alarm signals, and they're listening to the birds. So birds understand squirrelese, and squirrels understand birdies. So there's this very complex communication network. It's a distant early warning system, so to speak, made up of lots and lots of different species that share an environment, and they're all sharing information when a predator or when a threat shows up.
I think you had also mentioned chipmunks or monkeys also can understand some of the birds.
So, yes, here in North America, where I work in Montana, but all across North America, chipmunks and squirrels will be listening in to the birds and vice versa. But wherever you go around the world, so if you go to South America or Africa, or other places, Southeast Asia, where there's monkeys. Monkeys give lots of very specific alarm calls in response to seeing different kinds of predators. And so same thing goes on around the world. Birds are listening into the monkeys, and monkeys are listening into the birds and other critters as well.
And do you think, for example, that across, say, a species, that the language is universal across the globe? So, for example, migrating birds, would the other animals understand them in another region when they migrate?
Yes, this is a great question. One of the things I find especially fascinating is there appears to have been sort of an acoustic convergence around the world in these specific words, so to speak, these alarm calls around the world. So, for example, and as we delve into the details of this, birds will give a specific call we call a mobbing call in response to seeing a raptor, a hawk or a falcon or an owl or something that's perched, that's stationary. And this mobbing call, they sound very similar here in Montana or in California or in Europe or South America or just about anywhere in the world. There's these sounds that indicate a perched stationary raptor are very, very similar. They sound the same. And we can play some of these in a little bit. And similarly, there's what's called a seat alarm call that many birds produce. And that's given specifically to hawks that are flying, so that are actively hunting in the air. And this tends to be a much, much more dangerous situation for a bird if there's an active bird, an active raptor coming through the air at it. And these seat calls, again, many species all around the world have converged on the same sort of word, so to speak, or acoustic signal that indicates specifically a flying danger. So what's remarkable to me is I can record a seat call given by a chickadee here in North America, and I could go to South America or Africa or Europe or Australia and play that call, and the birds there would know exactly what it means. And I've done this, and the birds there, the first thing they do is stop whatever they're doing, get quiet. They look up to the sky. They scan the sky really quickly, and then generally they dive into the nearest bushes, so they seek cover immediately.
So how broadly does it go across species, do you think, the understandings?
Those are some of the things that my students and I and lots of other research scientists are trying to figure out, just how far these sorts of communication networks extend, what sorts of species are listening in and participating. But so far in the areas that we've looked, just about all the species in a habitat and an environment, they're all paying attention to the sounds that all the other species in that area are making when it comes to shared predators.
So one of the other things I thought was really interesting had to do with the frequency of the bird songs, for example, or the squirrel sounds, so that some animals really hear them, but the predator animals can't necessarily distinguish, so they don't know what's going on.
That's right. And this is especially true for the seat calls. The seat calls tend to be fairly high frequency, so high pitch. They're about, say, 8 to 10 kilohertz. And when we play some of these, you'll hear that. But hawks and owls and falcons tend not to be able to hear that well up in that high frequency range. But the birds that are producing them, they can hear those sounds. So it's a very clever adaptation to produce a warning signal that others can hear fairly well, but the predator can't really hear that. They're essentially producing this signal in a channel, in a bandwidth, so to speak, that the predators are pretty deaf. They really can't hear that sound. So it makes a lot of sense. The acoustic structure of these signals seems to be exceedingly well suited to the sort of function that they have.
So now, can we hear the distinctions?
Most people can hear seat calls and perfectly well. They're fairly high. A good bird watcher can identify hundreds of species of birds by their songs. That is, their sort of courtship signals.
How have you been able to do that?
Well, we're studying this communication networks out in nature. We've done some previous studies in aviaries with captive birds that we catch and we do studies with, and then we let them go again. But now we're really interested in looking at how these networks are working out in glorious, messy nature. So we use very, very sensitive microphones, and we can place microphones. We mic up whole big sections of habitats, so we can kind of map out these acoustic landscapes. And then we're using robotic raptors that we've made. So we've teamed up with really, really good taxidermists and talented students who can make robotic stuffed birds, and these things move just like real live raptors. They're very, very realistic. So, and then what we've done is we've got fake tree trunks, because if we just walked out in the woods carrying, say, a hawk, we'd kind of freak out everything that was there. But when we want to start these experiments, what we'll do is we can just walk out in the woods with what looks like a tree trunk, place it in the woods, and then back off. And when everything's settled down, we have a modified garage door opener. And so we push a button, and the tree trunk slowly slides down, revealing the scary hawk out in the woods. So that sort of starts the experiment. And then with these very sensitive microphones, we can tape the sounds, the alarm signals that all the species make in response to that specific robotic raptor that we've put out in the woods. And so we're using very carefully controlled experiments where we can put out a whole variety of different predators of different sizes and hunting strategies. And so we're sort of experimentally probing these alarm languages of the birds and mammals using these robotic raptors.
You've said that some of the specifics that these birds are communicating are really all the way down to what type of predator is in the area, how big it is, and you've been able to decode all that.
Yes, so that's one of the things that we're really interested in, is seeing just how much information is encoded in these calls. And to us, a lot of these alarm calls sound fairly similar, but when we analyze these with the help of computers and sort of sophisticated bioacoustical analyses, what the critters are showing us is that they're able to encode lots of information into these signals. So, for example, the alarm calls given to, let's say, by chickadees, which are real common all across most of the country, when we show them a predator such as a pygmy owl, which is this very cute, about a 3-inch tall owl, but it's very, very dangerous to them, when we show them a robotic pygmy owl, they produce alarm calls that are very different. They sound fairly similar to us, but to other chickadees, they sound different. And with the help of computers, we can see that there are acoustic differences between, say, their alarm calls in response to a pygmy owl versus a sharp-shinned hawk or a Cooper's hawk or a goshawk or a great horned owl and other things. So in essence, what we're finding is that what at the start kind of just seemed like an alarm call really seems to have much more information about the size or the threat level of the predator.
Urban noises. How is this affecting the bird song?
Yeah, that's
language.
Yes, that's a very, very important aspect of research that's going on now. So the world is getting noisier, so in not only urban areas and near highways and so forth, but across the West with a lot of oil and gas development going on, so compressor stations can put out a lot of noise. What we're finding is that some of these signals, these important signals, seem to be masked. So these subtle seat alarm calls, for example, are much harder to hear when there's a lot of noise created by people going on. And we're finding that in very noisy areas, for example, it seems like predators are having an easier time of catching and killing things simply because the sort of distant early warning system that critters are using to avoid being eaten, they just can't hear the alarm calls that are out there, so they're more vulnerable. This is an area of ongoing research right now with a lot of people interested in it, but it looks like noise pollution or louder environments created by people are having adverse effects on wildlife in some areas.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking with Eric Green about interspecies communication that he and his colleagues have discovered, particularly among birds and other small animals. Are the birds getting louder to compensate for it?
They don't seem to be getting louder. In some places, birds are shifting the frequencies of their calls so that a lot of noise pollution tends to be fairly low frequency, so lower pitch. So birds are nudging their songs and various calls to higher pitches, so it's sort of not being masked nearly as much by the lower frequency noise pollution. So there is some evidence that animals can change some of their signals to try to minimize the effect of noise pollution.
Well, why don't we listen to some of these birds and let you distinguish what's going on for us?
Yeah, this is really fun. So one sort of a general point I'd like to make is that although we really love to listen to sounds of the natural world, our ability to sort of neurologically process sounds really pales in comparison to lots of animals, such as birds. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to play just a couple really neat sounds, and I'm going to first play them in real speed, and then I'm going to play them slowed down to a third of their real speed. And when we do that, we can really begin to appreciate the amazing acoustic complexity of these songs. First of all, this is a bobolink, which is a bird related to blackbirds that I recorded in a grass field in my backyard here in Montana. So this is played in real speed. So that was a male bobolink. He produced that song when he's flying in a big circle around his territory. That was all one breath. And you could kind of hear that it's amazingly complex. Now I'm going to play it slowed down to one-third real speed. And now just sort of sit back and enjoy the amazing acoustic complexity of what this bird is able to produce as it's flying around.
And what is he saying?
He's probably saying, this is my territory, and if you're another male, keep off. But also, he's trying to attract females to his territory to breed with as well. So this acoustic complexity is probably saying, hey, check me out. I'm a pretty hot, sexy guy. Listen to all this amazing acoustic gymnastics I can do. We know from other studies that birds must be able to hear these sounds as if they're slowed down like this.
Well, let's go to another one.
It's a lot of birds, songbirds, have two sound-producing membranes in their throats. This is called the syrinx. We just have one sound-producing structure in our throats called the larynx. So if our brain tells the muscles to loosen up the larynx, our voice gets lower. And if our brain tells the muscles to tighten the larynx, her voice gets higher. So what I'm going to do now is play a thrush song. Thrushes are all around the world, and we've got a lot of species of thrushes here in North America. And they're beautiful songsters, and they're kind of magical sounds. And so this first one is a Swainson's thrush, which is a common thrush of western woods. And let's listen to it first in real speed, and just listen for this sort of this magical fluty quality. All right, now let's play it slowed down to one-third of its real speed, and now you can actually tell that it's playing a duet with itself. You can hear two sounds being produced at the same time. There, did you catch that duet?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty neat, isn't it? Let's play a robin song. So robins occur from the Pacific Ocean. They breed from Pacific to the Atlantic, to Gulf of Mexico, all the way up to the Arctic Ocean. They're one of the more common species all across North America from sea level to above tree line. And here's the song of a robin that probably everybody knows and loves. So beautiful harbinger of spring in lots of places. And now I'm going to play the sound of a robin giving a mobbing call when there was a perched raptor nearby. So this is a very, very specific call that robins give when there's perched danger.
And so what they're doing is asking the other birds to mob around this raptor.
That's right. this next sound is the same robin giving what's called a seat call to a flying hawk. So that perched raptor, if it then flew, the robin would change the sound it produces to give this seat call. And so you can hear it's this really high-frequency, thin-sounding whistle.
And so same bird, three different types of calls.
That's right. So I suspect that most people listening to this show know and love the robin song, but maybe less familiar with that robin, the mobbing call, or the seat call. But those are just three of the common vocalizations or calls that robins produce. They'll also say probably 20 other different things as well. We talked a little bit about how these sorts of languages or these communication codes have sort of converged all around the world. So here are some mobbing calls that I've put together from species from all the continents all around the world. And I'm going to give you a quiz after I play.
No. So those are quite a bit shorter, more direct, it seems.
Right. And what else? What sort of acoustic characteristics do they also share? So they're fairly loud.
Mm-hmm. They're like squawks
instead of
songs.
That's right. Yes, they're all fairly harsh and what we call broadband. They're really pretty obnoxious sounds, and this seems to really serve a function. These sounds carry a long way. They're loud. They're harsh. They're very, very easy to localize. So if I blindfolded you and spun you around and then played one of these mobbing alarm calls from somewhere, you would be able to point directly at it. It's a signal that goes a long way, and other critters can localize that sound very, very effectively. And so as a signal to sort of send out the alarm to bring in the troops, these sorts of mobbing calls, acoustically, they're structured in a way that really makes sense for the sort of job they do. And what's neat about that example, those were unrelated birds from all around the world producing these mobbing calls in response to perched raptor. We talked about this a little bit, but you can really kind of appreciate that if we played any one of those kind of anywhere else in the world, the local birds would understand it. They kind of know what it means.
We've got one more set.
Here's a really neat example of something that my students and I recorded. This was in last winter. It was here in Montana in the snowy, very, very cold woods. It was about 20 below zero. And the woods were really quiet at the time. There was not a lot of sounds going on. So this sort of distant early warning system was turned off. But we had mics out in the woods, and we had hidden our tree trunk with a robotic northern goshawk underneath it. So northern goshawks are large forest hawks, and they're very, very dangerous to Steller's jays, which are common sort of western jay. They're the equivalent. In the east we have the blue jay, in the west we have Steller's jays. What I want you to listen for is we pushed the button on our garage door opener, and the fake tree trunk slid down, revealing this very realistic robotic goshawk, and there happened to be one Steller's jay nearby that saw it, and it immediately gave what's called a wah alarm call. And then if you listen carefully, you'll be able to hear very distant Steller's jays far away in the woods, but immediately they answer, and as the recording goes on, you can hear them getting closer and closer in response to this call to arms. And by the end of the recording, there's probably 20 or 30 Steller's jays right around the robotic goshawk, and they're all going crazy. So you can sort of acoustically hear how powerful these mobbing calls are at bringing in the troops.
Shh. 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 That sounds kind of terrifying.
Well, that's the whole idea, I guess. It seems a little counterintuitive, doesn't it, that if you're a bird out there and you detect a predator, why should you produce a sound that lets the predator know where you are? It seems counterintuitive. But what seems to be going on is that if a hawk or a falcon or an owl or something is perched, it's actually less dangerous at the moment. And by calling in lots of help to harass and mob the predator, what happens is its cover's been busted, everybody knows where it is, so the chance of it being able to successfully catch something and kill something is much reduced. And so what happens is, with these big mobbing events, we know that the hawks, the raptor that's been detected, tends to just get out of dodge, just tends to fly and fly much farther than it would have had it not been discovered. So it just gets out of the area and starts over trying to hunt more unsuspecting prey. It really does seem to be hard to be a hawk in some ways, because if you're detected, there's this very efficient communication network made up of tons of species that are spreading the word about where you are and who you are and what you're doing and so forth.
I think you actually have multiple species also calling to arms to one of your robots, the pygmy owl, as well. Should we take a listen to that?
Yeah, this is, again, recorded last winter in very cold Montana woods. And this was a little, so the goshawk stands about 2 feet high, pretty large hawk. This pygmy owl is about 3 inches tall, only slightly larger than, say, a chickadee, but they're very dangerous. Like 80% of their diet can be chickadees during the winter in some places. So what we're going to play now is just listening to this call to arms in response to our robotic pygmy owl out in the woods here in Montana. If you listen, there's many species in this mobbing. There's a very nasal sort of that's a red-breasted nuthatch, or many red-breasted nuthatches. There's black-capped chickadees, and there's also mountain chickadees that sound like sort of chickadees with a sore throat. And there's many other species involved in this mobbing event.
Even though that's a mobbing call, there's still something really kind of beautiful and sweet about it.
Yeah, it's a different, if you attune your ears to what's going on out in the woods, not just songs about, hey, I'm sexy and this is my territory, but all these other different kind of calls, just a walk in the woods becomes even more enchanting and fascinating. And you can kind of start to play Dr. Doolittle and pay attention to what the animals are telling each other. So if you're out in the woods and you hear sort of commotions like these couple that we've just played, go check it out, because there might be a little owl or a big owl or a hawk sitting in a tree that you otherwise would have missed. Also, if you're in the woods and if things get really quiet all of a sudden, and then you start to hear these seat calls, like these high-pitched seat calls, look around, because there is a flying hawk somewhere in the woods. And if you're lucky, you might see it go zooming by, but it might be a couple minutes, because these distant early warning systems, we've clocked these waves of information traveling through the woods, in some cases at over 100 miles an hour, so that a hawk flying through the woods, there's this bow wave of information that precedes it, and oftentimes the birds and the chipmunks and squirrels and so forth are hiding in the deepest cover, you know, a couple minutes before the hawk even gets there.
Well, Eric Green, thank you so much for sharing your research with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for your interest, and I hope people find it interesting.
When we come back, how are the new corporate leaders at Uber, Google, and Airbnb operating outside of the rule of law? Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Some corporate leaders have been comparing themselves to civil rights leaders and their lawlessness to civil disobedience, all while violating some civil rights. How are the new corporate leaders at Uber, Google, and Airbnb operating outside of the rule of law, and how is it affecting societies? With us is Siva Vaidyanathan. He is a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia and the author of The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry. Welcome back to the Scholars Circle. It's great to have you back here again. Last time we had you on was for your book, The Googleization of Everything. So I wondered, before we get into this latest opinion piece that you wrote, if you could write the latest epilogue for that book, what would it say?
What I was trying to do with The Googleization of Everything was get people to think about the ways that Google affects our lives and what it means to outsource so many important decisions in our daily life to one company's algorithms, to trust the company so deeply that decisions about what is true, what is good, what is beautiful, what tastes good, what the best recipe is, all of these things, we deeply trust Google to the point that we just automatically respond to its response to us. And it's a really fascinating, complex feedback mechanism, a constant conversation between ourselves and Google, not just on an individual level, but on a collective level. So the fact that this is the most fascinating company in the world, perhaps the most fascinating company in the history of the world, was good enough for me. But I really wanted people to understand just how wacky this whole thing is. In this very short period of time, we've done this. Now, that phenomenon has not changed. A lot of what Google does in daily life has changed. So, for instance, by 2011, when that book came out, I had no way of discussing the fact that Google, now Alphabet, was very interested in generating a self-driving car, building off of the Maps and GPS project that it had brought in, and then creating a vehicle that could navigate itself around the world. That's mind-blowing. That's controversial. That's certainly worthy of policy debates and ethical debates and all sorts of other debates. Right now, I would obviously have to write about that, but I would encapsulate everything in a bigger idea that I wish had occurred to me back then, and that is the operating system of our lives. Because when I look at the big information companies in the world, I look at Facebook, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, and Apple. All of these companies basically do their own thing, and they're all making the money that they can, in many cases big money, with the exception of Amazon, which barely breaks even. And they're doing so without necessarily directly competing, although Facebook and Amazon compete for advertisements. And Facebook and Google compete for advertisements online, and Apple and Google compete to be the operating system of our mobile devices, right? Those are the intersections of competition. But for the most part, they could all stay in their lanes and continue to print money, and everyone would be very happy with all their shareholders and employees would be very happy. But they all seem to be doing so much more. They all seem to have these grand ambitions. And so I was trying to unpack those grand ambitions and try to make sense of it. And from their starting points, they all are striving to become the operating system of our lives. They all want to manage the data flow that they see coming to our home appliances, to our automobiles, to our clothing, to our eyeglasses, to our home entertainment systems. So Google, for instance, buys Nest, a company best known for smart thermostats. Google buys a robot company, a mind-blowing robot company from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Facebook tries to become a more important part of our lives, tries to be the central point for sending text messages to everybody. You know, every move Facebook tries is to become a bigger, deeper part of our consciousness. Apple is trying so many different things with new devices to be the operating system of our lives. And whoever wins this, it's going to have a tremendous amount of power in the world. And chances are, because of standardization, that company, maybe two companies, will have a monopoly or oligopoly over far more than our digital lives, over far more than web advertising. You know, the idea of the web might not even matter anymore if we're talking about, you know, pure information dumps and downloads to our skin, to our eyes, you know, to our vehicles, to our homes. And so that idea, the operating system of our lives, I think if I could do a new version today, that's how I would frame the big idea that Google's after, because that's also something shared with all these other companies.
And probably most importantly, to our brains.
Right. And that's what's really interesting. You know, when I say the operating system of our lives, you could probably substitute that phrase for the more common phrase you hear in daily conversation and in news reports, and that is the Internet of Things. I can't stand the phrase the Internet of Things because it's neither an internet nor about things. The internet is an open, customizable, malleable system where, in theory, we are all supposed to have the ability to interact with it and openly contribute to the wealth and structure and code of it if we need to. That's what's fascinating about it and unique about it in human history. Whatever's coming, this digital stream that is going to have to be, it seems, controlled top down by one or more of a hand of these companies, is not going to be anything like the internet. It's going to be a tightly controlled, as secure as possible, totally privatized set of network interactions that will have nothing to do with the internet. It won't look or feel like the internet at all. And it won't be about things. It'll be about bodies and minds. It'll be about humans. It really is about connecting us and our lives and all those things around us, our cars, our thermostats, our homes. Those are merely, as Marshall McLuhan said, extensions of ourselves. You know, our homes are merely extensions of our skin, because our skin can't provide protection from the elements. And so we created a technology called clothes that are an extension of our clothes. And when that was insufficient, we created another extension, which is an abode, a hut, or a modern, you know, mini mansion outside of Houston. When it comes right down to it, if you're talking about data flows controlling our home or our cars, it really is about controlling our bodies, plugging our bodies into electronic feedback loops, vast data sets, and algorithms that we're not allowed to understand.
Facebook in particular is the one that I find the most fascinating because of the amount of time, and it's sort of like a capsule within which people live.
Well, they wish. Right? Facebook wishes it were all that. What's really interesting is, for a time, it looked like that where we were headed into a situation where, at least when it comes to our social interactions, we learn about the world. Facebook was growing and dominant. You know, look, it still has a billion users, which is amazing, and it's growing like crazy in important places like India and Brazil. But it's kind of tapped out in terms of penetration in the U.S. Young people, I can tell you from firsthand knowledge, find Facebook to be essential but not complete. Their communicative lives and social lives are so much more rich and supplemented by WeChat if they're global citizens, or Snapchat if they're local citizens, or Instagram, which, of course, Facebook owns. So their social networks and social systems are not exclusive to Facebook anymore, which, you know, drives Facebook crazy. It's one of the reasons Facebook is constantly trying new things to give people a reason just to hang out in the Facebook interface a bit longer than they already do. Facebook would love to be the place you search for restaurant recommendations and recipes rather than how you use Google right now. Facebook would love to be your news feed about the world the way that people use Twitter now. So Facebook is a fascinating company in itself. I think it's kind of topping off right now. It hasn't made the bold moves it wanted to make. It tried to create an operating system for mobile devices. It tried to make the Facebook app so central that they hoped you wouldn't need other apps on a mobile device. That hasn't worked out. And I'm not sure they know what their next move is, although it looks like virtual reality might be the thing they're betting on. They have purchased the most interesting virtual reality companies around, and they might actually want to be an immersive entertainment source through virtual reality. So we'll see how that goes. And Microsoft is after the same thing. They're also very aggressive in trying to get into virtual reality right now.
Now let's move to this other piece that you have been looking at, which deals with the so-called sharing economy. You wrote this piece in The Guardian called Uber and the Lawlessness of Sharing Economy Corporates.
Very British usage there in the headline, right?
Right. Maybe the place to start is we call them sharing economies, but isn't that a misnomer? Right.
Totally. First of all, economy is a bit too grandiose here. You know, we're talking about a handful of businesses that have certainly made an impression on the world and have inspired other people to model new companies after them and have affected the daily lives of a lot of people who live in urban areas and can afford smartphones and the data that goes along with them, which is not an insubstantial number or class of people, but it is still fairly limited. If you don't have a smartphone, you're not using Uber anyway. If you don't have a credit card, you're not using Uber anyway. You know, and if you're not a sophisticated user of digital platforms, you're not using Airbnb. And so while both of these companies now have global reach with certain pockets that have been shut off to them by regulation, to say that it's an economic phenomenon is a bit of a stretch right now. It's an interesting marginal phenomenon which has almost no effect on GDP anywhere, but it's certainly worthy of examination because culturally I think these things are fascinating.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We're talking with Siva Vaidyanathan about the new corporate lawlessness and what it is doing to societies across the globe. The other part that perhaps is a misnomer is the idea that it's really sharing that much because still big corporations.
If I borrow my roommate's car for a date, that's sharing. The Uber guy is not going to let me borrow his car. There's no share going on here. It is a taxi service, and it's a particularly structured taxi service. It's a particularly efficient way of distributing the resource of ride granting to a mobile population that has certain surge moments of demand. And so, you know, the algorithmic and data-driven innovations are fascinating in and of themselves, and certainly a lot of other companies are trying to learn from that. But no, there's no sharing going on. Airbnb is a lot more like sharing than Uber. They don't actually have anything in common, except that they're both threatening the status quo of how cities govern themselves. Cities around the world have for years done their best to regulate and tax hotel rooms, regulate and tax taxi services. And in both those cases, Uber and Airbnb are undermining those efforts. And that's really where the debate is. There are arguments, good arguments, for the case that Uber and Airbnb are exposing and undermining regulatory systems that are archaic, anti-competitive, bad for consumers. That's, you know, an argument on that plane is fine. And then the argument that Frank Pasquale and I made in that article in The Guardian is the opposite, which is let's not assume that all of these regulations around the world that govern these institutions are illegitimate or improper. It's really up to the people of Paris and the people of St. Petersburg and the people of Manila and the people of Delhi and the people of New York and the people of San Francisco to decide what regulatory system they want to have for these sorts of services, to decide how revenue should be grabbed, to decide whether their methods of regulation are legitimate and proper and whether there might be a better way. But instead of having those sorts of reasoned debate with real policy analysis and then ultimately calm deliberation, which, you know, may be a fantasy anyway, we're seeing what Frank Pasquale and I call corporate nullification. And this was the idea. Frank is a law professor at the University of Maryland, and he wrote a brilliant book called The Black Box Society that just came out this spring. And this book examines the ways that algorithms run our lives, from insurance and banking through search engines and social networks, and the fact that there's so much unaccountability there. And so he and I were thinking along the same lines over the past few months as we watched Uber get into conflict after conflict in New York, in Paris, in London, elsewhere. And as we followed this news, we started conversing a bit, and I brought up this phrase. I said, what about corporate nullification? Because it seems like in California, Uber's making the case that labor laws do not apply to it because it's new and special. So if you're claiming laws do not apply to you, you know, that's kind of a nullification move. That's a way of saying this law isn't relevant, and the justification for that is sort of the opposite of the conservatism that informed Southern slaveholders and segregationists when they tried to nullify federal laws, which was, this is how we've always done things. So from a conservative point of view, you know, a traditional point of view, corporate nullification of this kind is, these laws are irrelevant to us because they're not about the future, and we're about the future, and we're about innovation, a word I hate, you know. And so the rhetorical field for this debate is so bad right now that if you're against Uber, you're against the future. Well, that's no way to start a conversation and figure out the best way to have these things. Maybe having services like Uber and Lyft is good for cities around the world, maybe not all cities. Maybe some cities, you know, maybe it's a great thing in San Francisco and not such a good thing in New York. Maybe it's a great thing in Los Angeles and not in Seattle. Maybe it's a great thing in London and not Paris. So our argument was, you know, look, regulations are important. You can't just sweep them away and assume that it's about incumbent industries capturing them and protecting themselves. That does happen, but you don't know that for sure. This is a good opportunity to have those fights out. So that's where the idea of corporate nullification came down. Unfortunately, I had Frank working on these issues from his point of view as a legal scholar who thinks a lot about algorithms, and then I was able to work through it back and forth with him. And you know, The Guardian really dug the idea, and we're really proud of the article. It managed to get a lot of conversation going, a lot of debate going. The concept of corporate nullification, I think, has legs in a lot of different areas beyond Airbnb and Google and Uber, the three companies we mentioned, you know, but as corporations grow in power and political power, if you can imagine them getting more powerful than they are today, we are looking at a potential moment in human history where we are coming back to the moment of the British East India Company and the Dutch East India Company operating as quasi-states, making up their own rules, having their own instruments of power, and being virtually immune to the regulatory systems and wishes of the local populations they affect. And we should be worried about that potential. We have lots of historical examples of concentrated corporate power being that bold. And one of the reasons that we created the modern state in the 20th century was to curb the excesses of such powerful institutions. One of the reasons Adam Smith wrote On the Wealth of Nations was to undermine the status of those big multinational corporations that were essentially in restraint of trade. They were messing with people's ability to seek out the good life for themselves. They were having values imposed on them. And Frank and I both see similar echoes in our current political economy and political rhetoric.
You just mentioned also that Google is among them with these sort of corporate nullification efforts. In your article, you noted that one of the ways in which Google does this is with privacy laws, with copyright laws. Give us a little description of how this looks and update us with some of the lawsuits.
Sure. Well, Google Street View is a program that started around 2005. Google started sending its cars around to streets in the world with cameras mounted on top, taking 360-degree images of as many streets as they could drive down. And in the United States, people thought it was kind of cool and kind of harmless, and nobody really protested. There was one lawsuit from a couple outside of Pittsburgh because the Google car drove up their driveway and took pictures of their house. That lawsuit was tossed out pretty fast. But, you know, Google has pretty clearly violated privacy laws in much of Europe where you are not supposed to take pictures of people for commercial purposes without their permission, in general, in most countries in Europe. And the very fact that the images themselves were just so hard to police and patrol for people, and there were lots of images of children and some images of children naked and images of people doing embarrassing things. And what happened was European privacy regulators tried to crack down on Google, and in some places they managed to. But for the most part, Google's MO was shoot pictures first and ask questions later, ask permission later, or don't ask permission. Like, flip the default. Google would go around shooting all these pictures and then create a service that it hoped would be so popular that the regulators could not crush it. because there would be a popular uproar. That was the assumption. That's what it tried to do with Google Book Search, too. When it started scanning in all of these copyrighted books, it knew it was going to face lawsuits from publishing companies and authors, but it figured it would create such an important, valuable, interesting service that it would have the gut feeling of a good thing going for it. And it actually worked. So ultimately, at this point in time, Google has prevailed in its lawsuits, in the lawsuits that the publishers brought against it, at least in the United States. So it's a really fascinating thing where Google just says, look, I'm going to roll out something. I know it breaks the law, or at least is going to invite a lawsuit, but we're going to rewrite the law through practice because we think we're doing something so super popular, so transformative, so revolutionary, so innovative, that there'll be enough popular will behind it to let it survive in some form. And for the most part, Google has managed to do that. So I think Google sort of set the standard for this, although you know, could argue that Napster tried to do that with its service to find MP3s on people's computers. Napster's position was, well, let's make this thing so super popular that the music business, sure, music business could sue us out of business, but won't it just kind of figure, isn't it better to settle and figure out how to monetize this thing? Of course, the music business wasn't smart enough to take that bait and instead crushed Napster as a company, but never crushed the concept of file sharing, and it missed out on a brilliant opportunity. So, you know, we've seen this time and time again, and now we're seeing it with Uber and Airbnb, where they are marching into a town and saying, you know, forget the regulations. We're special. We're new. And we're going to become so popular that if regulators, like the mayor of New York, for instance, Bill de Blasio, want to take a stand and say, you know what, we are really concerned about traffic congestion in Manhattan, and we have no way of regulating traffic congestion in Manhattan with this many cabs, because there are so many new Uber cabs out there. We need to put a stop to it, or at least manage the traffic better. And then Uber was able to create a AstroTurf popular uprising among, you know, wealthy Uber users to stop de Blasio's efforts to re-regulate the system. So it's just been chaos.
A couple of other aspects that you brought up in that piece, juxtaposing this argument that they're like civil rights leaders using this civil disobedience, when in fact, in many ways, they're doing the opposite. Uber's facing a lawsuit from an organization that represents blind people because of how much they refuse to pick up blind people. And so it's sort of the antithesis of civil rights organizations, and yet they're trying to put forward that that is their ethos.
That's right.
The other thing I wanted to bring up is now how many corporates are using these systems like Airbnb, for example, big landlords using Airbnb but kicking out their longtime tenants because they make more money by renting out their rooms on the Airbnb system.
You know, that's a really scary phenomenon. But, you know, look, landlords in big cities, big congested cities with high rents and that are popular tourist distractions have long tried to find ways to kick out long-term residents. So using Airbnb for it, I think, says more about the landlord problem than it does about the Airbnb problem. But Airbnb problem is interesting because at its sort of simplest level, it's not a problem. There's excess capacity, lots of couches and beds that could be occupied by people who don't want to spend hotel rates. But the other problem is a lot of cities deeply depend on the tax revenue from hotels. And if people are going to start staying in apartments at a large scale rather than hotels, and it actually shifts demand away from hotels, then cities are going to lose a lot of revenue, and they're not going to be able to pave the streets or pay for police or pay for teachers. And there's going to be a big problem there. And where is that revenue going to come from? Is it going to have to come from some new real estate tax? Whether or not that's going to have that kind of effect, I think, is a real concern for certain cities.
Back to the issue of the so-called civil rights, these companies, they're not necessarily really sharing profits. They're just big corporations, mostly traded on Wall Street, giving a little bit of money to their various people who share in tiny amounts. How can they make this argument?
Well, you know, look, modesty is not the sort of attribute that makes one a corporate CEO. You know, to lead that kind of life, to choose that life, almost necessitates a stunning amount of arrogance. And so we should expect that. And in this case, though, they see themselves as coming from the future. People who worked so hard for civil rights were fighting the past, fighting for a better future. And so they see themselves in that sense. You know, they are liberated from and liberating people from superstitions and bigotries and old ways of thinking and calcified business models, all of which seems to be, to them anyway, what happened in the civil rights movement, but it's a very poor sense of what actually happened in the civil rights movement. So, you know, that's kind of where they're coming from. But Uber's position on one of the most important civil rights laws of the last 40 years, which is the Americans with Disabilities Act, is, yes, of course, individual drivers should follow the Americans with Disabilities Act, but they are not our employees, so Uber as a company need not follow that law. Uber as a company need not be held responsible for the fact that the drivers clearly violate the law. You know, and that's just a stunning level of arrogance in its own sense, and a stunning lack of concern for the needs of people who we as a people have said deserve equal access to these sorts of facilities. So, you know, it's a really sad comment on where we are in terms of how we discuss politics, history, and civil rights, that we get that tangled and that confused about what actually is going on with civil rights.
Well, Siva Vaidyanathan, it's great to have you back here on the Scholar Circle. I'm looking forward to seeing how this unfolds and talking again very soon.
I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible.
To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.